In this podcast, do body cooling devices really work? And if so, how can you use them during exercise? How to get your body to burn more fat? Greens to Go from Costco. Is insulin growth factor good or bad? Are chia seeds good for exercise? Do you need to worry about big veins? Is carbonated water okay? Drinking oxygen from a can? High-calorie foods that are actually healthy, how often you should work out, how fast to pedal a bike, and a question about my diet as a kid.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Well, folks, today is the first of a two-part podcast series on using temperature to manipulate your performance and manipulate your weight, meaning using the fluctuations between cold and hot exposure to actually kind of hack your body and make it do cool things. So you'll enjoy today's interview with Chris Bohannon, and he's going to talk about how to use cooling devices, cooling gear, how they work, what they do, and whether they're worth getting into. So the other thing, of course, is we have our listener Q&A, a few special announcements. So we'll go ahead and jump into this week's content for podcast number 129 from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Special announcements.
All right. First of all, if you've listened to this podcast in the past, heard me talk about things like the Mount Capra double bonded whey protein as being the protein that I recommend people use if they're going to use a whey protein. You've heard me talk about antioxidants and how I use one called Solar Synergy. We've received many questions about glucosamine chondroitin. And in many of my responses, I've mentioned that the only one that I've really found much success with for myself, for my clients, is one called CapraFlex. And then finally, of course, you've heard me talk a lot about vitamin D and about fish oil. Well, in the past, whenever I've talked about that stuff for you guys, I've had to send you off to, you know, the four corners of the internet to kind of find the stuff that I personally recommend and use. And I've now made all those items available over at the supplements page at Pacific Elite Fitness, meaning that if you already use things like Enterprime or Thermofactor or Lean Factor or Delta E or any of the other compounds that you've heard me recommend before on the show, you now have the convenience of being able to grab your protein, your antioxidants, glucosamine, any of that stuff all at the same time in the same place. So all of that is available. I've also been able to broker some pretty low prices on it, so you're getting it for a lot better deal than you're going to get it anywhere else. I had to do a little bit of footwork to be able to make that happen, but it's happened and it's all available now. I'll not only put a link to that in the show notes, but for those of you who have ordered supplements before from Pacific Elite Fitness, it's available from the same place that you've gotten that stuff before. And of course, like I mentioned last week, the other thing that's available over there now is the full panel for testing for food allergies. I've chosen the gold standard food allergy testing protocol that is available through Diagnostex and made that available to you again at the same convenient time that you grab your other stuff. So if you want to get food allergy tested or know what's going on inside your gut, this thing screens not only for food allergies, but parasites, yeast, fungus, pretty much anything wrong that could be going on inside your digestive tract. So check that out. Another couple things I wanted to mention. The first is that we just did our first live video webinar for the people over at Ben Greenfield Fitness Inner Circle. It was fantastic. I talked about staying fit and trim while you travel. My wife showcased a ton of different kitchen ingredients you'd be crazy not to have around if you're serious about being healthy. And then we made that video available inside the members area over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/innercircle. Central. We're having a lot of fun over there. I'll tell you straightforward, that's $17 a month to be part of that, and it's just a ton of extra information, forum access, videos, etc. So bengreenfieldfitness.com/innercircle, great way to stay healthy and learn how to do it practically, learn how to do it cheap, learn how to do it with no guesswork, and of course, learn how to do it with 24/7 guidance from Jessa and myself. And then finally, Chef Todd, my friend Chef Todd, is just in the last few days of his giving away the farm post-holiday sale. He took all his DVDs, tons of his web cooking resources, and is basically just dumping them for a super low price. So if you go over there to the link that I put in the show notes to Chef Todd's website, be sure to check that out. You've basically got, if you're listening to this podcast on the day that it comes out, you've only got 3 more days to check that out and to get Chef Todd's stuff. So be sure to go to the show notes for podcast episode 129 for access to any of that stuff. So we're going to have a special message and then move on to this week's listener Q&A.
Get the inside edge from Ben Greenfield Fitness delivered straight to your phone. Just text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll instantly get exclusive VIP discounts and insider tips that no one else will ever see except you. Do it now. Text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll be in Ben's VIP text club for free.
Listener Q&A.
Remember, if you have a question for the podcast, you can ask it by going to bengreenfieldfitness.com and clicking on any of the episode show notes, scrolling down to the Ask Ben form and asking your question there. The other way that you can ask is, of course, if you have the free Ben Greenfield Fitness iPhone app, you can just click the Ask Ben button right there on your app. And then you can ask via Twitter. And our first question actually comes through via Twitter from twitter.com/BenGreenfield. And here's the question from Chunky Bear Cub. If training fasted makes you more efficient at burning fat, won't your body prefer to burn carbohydrate when you rest as a result? This question stems from my recommendation to train in a fasted state so that you tap into your fat stores a little bit more efficiently. Not to do that all the time, but to include some sessions where you're training your body to more efficiently burn fat. And more specifically, when I used to do metabolic tests on people in my physiology lab, what I would find is that most people coming in straight off the street, when you hooked them up to a respirometer and measured the amount of fat versus the amount of carbohydrate utilized during exercise, most people use a mix of fat and carbohydrate and kind of cycle between the two. But people who are well-trained, and specifically lots of endurance athletes, tend to have a more even fat utilization curve. Not only do they utilize a greater percentage of fat, but they burn more calories as a whole during exercise. And so what happens is you essentially have your body trained to burn more calories and burn more fat. Now, what this listener is asking is, if you train in that fasted state to make yourself more efficient at burning fat, wouldn't your body burn carbohydrate when you're resting? So if you're training yourself to burn more fat during exercise, wouldn't your body burn more carbohydrate during exercise? The simple answer to that is no. The body's preferential fuel source at rest is fat. And even when you're walking around the house, whatever, cleaning, gardening, doing the laundry, walking up and down the stairs, you're primarily just burning fat. It's only when you begin to exercise that your body starts to tap into carbohydrate. The trick is to train at least a few times a week in a way that teaches your body how to burn more fat during exercise, so that the point at which you start tapping into carbohydrates occurs at a higher intensity. So you're getting the best of both worlds. You're helping your body to burn more fat as a fuel, but you're also helping yourself to go longer and harder before you start to tap into carbohydrate as a fuel. And the only thing that that type of training is going to do is help you burn even more fat at rest. It's not going to cause you to burn carbohydrate at rest. So The next question comes from listener David, and David asks, could you please give your opinion on greens to go available at Costco? Well, I know a lot of you shop at Costco, or it's also known as Sam's Club in a few places. And basically, the greens to go is a powder that you mix into water. I've used it before. It is primarily made up of a barley grass juice. That's where the greens part of it comes from. And then they also typically will put some herbs, some spices in there. They sweeten it with no extra sugar, but rather with a little bit of a stevia extract, and they mix that with xylitol, which is a more natural sugar alcohol. The other components that you'll find in something like this include kind of what you'll see in a lot of green supplements, just a shotgun of different superfoods. They've got grapeseed extract and pine bark extract, broccoli, spinach, kale, Brussels sprouts, etc. I am definitely not against taking this stuff. This is not going to do any damage to your body. It's not one of those supplements that has a bunch of red flags around it in terms of added artificial sweeteners or preservatives or chemicals. And for the most part, it is fine. Again, I kind of return to the thing that I always say when I talk about these green supplements. I've tried just about everyone that is out there. I have never found one that I can literally feel almost instantly like I can the Enerprime stuff that I take. Granted, the Enerprime doesn't taste quite as good as some of this stuff, especially if you get the powder, because it literally is just, it tastes like wheatgrass. If you've ever done a shot of wheatgrass, that's what it tastes like. But I never get sick when I take this stuff, and I can literally feel it surging through my bloodstream right away. So the greens to go, definitely not going to do any damage with that. You're probably going to get a lot of benefit from it, but compared to Enerprime, I really don't think it holds a candle. So that's my response to that. Dan has one of the more interesting questions on today's podcast. He says, can you discuss insulin-like growth factor 1? Because it seems a bit confusing. The fitness community seems to embrace it. They even have a diet called GOD, or God, gallon of milk per day, where athletes indirectly get huge amounts of insulin-like growth factor. And this crowd downplays any health concerns and states how wonderful the stuff can be. The other group of people are not selling milk or human growth hormone, but may be selling sensationalism and seem to be warning of cancer and other health problems from dairy, and specifically, but not limited to, the growth hormones added to cow's milk. There are websites that discuss growth hormone stimulators and insulin-like growth factor as very dangerous, and state that even whey protein may be dangerous because of insulin-like growth factor. Any simple guidelines you can provide for optimum health? Okay, so before we even really explain what insulin-like growth factor is, we need to take a step back and explain what growth hormone is. And growth hormone is a protein-based hormone that's produced by your body that stimulates things like muscle growth, cell reproduction, cell regeneration. It is extremely crucial to your function in everyday life, not only to your recovery from exercise, but things as simple as your ability to grow bone density or grow new cells. And the idea is that your liver produces something called insulin-like growth factor. And when your liver secretes that, it is secreting that in response to growth hormone. So when your body creates growth hormone, it stimulates the liver to release insulin-like growth factor. And what the insulin-like growth factor does is it has a ton of roles, but it can regulate neural development, so the growth of your brain and all the synapses and neurons within your brain. It can stimulate muscle hypertrophy, so meaning the growth of the size of muscle cells, or the addition of new muscle cells or muscle fiber in many cases. Protein synthesis, it can block muscle atrophy or muscle breakdown. It is crucial for producing your cartilage cells, so you've got a lot of joint protection going on when you have your levels of insulin growth factor circulating. It's associated with the activation of osteocytes, and osteocytes are basically the anabolic factors in your bone. They're what causes your bone to grow more dense. And at very high concentrations, insulin growth factor is capable of activating the insulin receptor on the cells, and it basically can complement the effects of insulin, meaning that it can cause sugar to get stored as energy more quickly, and it can also result in the actual release of insulin. And this is where the people who are kind of against insulin-like growth factor will say, okay, if you're consuming a food that's going to cause this huge release of insulin growth factor, and dairy, frankly, does that. That's the reason that milk causes small animals to grow into big animals so well. But what people say is if you're doing that, then you're getting these huge releases of insulin and high levels of chronically high levels of circulating insulin could cause your cell receptors to become insensitive to insulin. And when that happens, you end up getting high blood sugar levels. And high blood sugar levels, of course, can cause damage to your blood vessels. They can put you at risk for type 2 diabetes. They can kind of put your energy levels plummeting up and down like a roller coaster. And so there's a lot of health and energy effects that are really not all that pleasant that occur when we've got these huge levels of circulating insulin. Now, here's the deal. Here's the practical way to look at this. It's only a problem to have insulin growth factor circulating in your body and high levels of circulating insulin if you are a sedentary, inactive person, or if you're in a sedentary, inactive state. Meaning that if you are not putting yourself into a state where your body is depleted of energy and needs to get that stimulation to store sugars as energy or to repair muscle fibers, then all you're doing is doing yourself a disservice by chronically stimulating your insulin levels to higher and higher levels. But if you're exercising, you're breaking down muscle, you are putting yourself in a situation where recovery is paramount and the growth of new bone and new muscle is paramount, then this insulin growth factor comes in quite handy. And so really, both camps are right. The camp that says, oh, milk can be bad for you, all these growth hormones can be bad for you, the insulin growth factor can be bad for you. Well, they're right when you're talking about an inactive, non-exercising population or population that needs to lose weight. But when you're talking about an athlete or somebody who's frequently exercising or even a child who's growing, these type of growth hormones and insulin-like growth factors can come in very handy. Now, the reason for that, of course, is that they contribute immensely to your recovery. That's why chocolate milk is a fantastic recovery drink. Now, of course, the caveat to all this is the modern dairy industry. And the primary issue with this is not only the fact that pasteurization is destroying a lot of the enzymes that help us to digest milk, and so a lot of people have an allergic or an intolerant reaction to milk, but the other issue is that there is a ton of extra growth hormone being added to the milk, so we're getting even a greater insulin-like growth factor release than we would from like a normal natural milk or like a raw milk. So there's some issues with dairy. The other issue that we've talked about on this show before is that milk from a cow has a lot larger protein size in it than a milk from something like a goat or an animal that's closer to the size of a human being. And so a lot of times we just aren't absorbing the proteins from something like a cow's milk as well as we are from a goat. But again, most of these issues are issues that are more serious for a sedentary, inactive population. And whereas you'll hear people who are against dairy argue that humans are the only people who drink milk past the point of weaning or past the point of being a very small animal dependent on its mother, that's really true. But for thousands of years, one of the things that coaches and trainers have known is that athletes require some type of milk source as a source of recovery, or it's a very, very good source of recovery. It's kind of like one of the secret recovery supplements that you can take in. So the fact that other animals aren't competing in the Olympics should be taken into consideration as well. It is no secret that milk is great for building big muscles and enhancing recovery immensely. So basically what this comes down to, and to answer your question, is that the simple guideline is that if you are sedentary, if you are inactive, if that's just the type of person you are, or if you're in a sedentary, inactive state, like you're not exercising, you're sitting at your desk, you have a rest day or whatever, you really shouldn't be doing much milk, much insulin growth factor, much growth hormone. But if you are exercising and you're able to tolerate lactose and you don't have a dairy allergy or something like that, then eating a dairy product or drinking milk post-exercise is just fine and is going to help you recover. The last question that you asked was regarding growth hormone and these growth hormone stimulating supplements. There's a big difference between taking HGH or taking growth hormone, which is can actually be pretty dangerous. It can result in high blood pressure. It can result in a lot of joint pain. It can have some sleep disturbances. And there's some issues in terms of shutting down your body's own natural ability to produce growth hormone. There's a big difference between taking growth hormone like that, injecting growth hormone, taking synthetic growth hormones, and taking growth hormone precursors. So what I mean by that is a growth hormone precursor would be something probably the most popular one is GABA or gamma aminobutyric acid. And what that is it's something that's added to recovery supplements. It's actually added to sleep aids a lot of the time too, like the Somnedrin GH that I've talked about before on the show. And that's more of just a gentle growth hormone release effect. It's not the same as taking a needle and injecting human growth hormone into your body. It's a much, much lower level of growth hormone release, just a little bit of an extra advantage in recovery, and does not have the same effect as a synthetic growth hormone. It can cause some drowsiness, can cause you to go to sleep a little bit sooner. You shouldn't take it while you're operating heavy machinery, but you'll get a nice recovery effect from taking something like GABA without the side effects of straight up injecting human growth hormone. So you can't paint with a broad brush and say that if you're taking HGH, you are going to shut down your body's own natural production of HGH. You're going to get a lot of the nasty side effects that come along with taking HGH stimulants. The fact is that there's a big difference between just injecting HGH and taking small amounts of an HGH precursor like gamma aminobutyric acid. So, long answer, but it was a long question, and hopefully I did it some justice. And leave your comments or your questions on the show notes for this podcast, podcast number 129, if you have some follow-up thoughts. So next, Bracken asks, I read the book Born to Run. They mentioned chia seeds, and I got some. I've been eating them with yogurt every morning. Are you a fan? Why haven't they hit the more mainstream if they're as power-packed as they seem to be? Well, chia seeds are a pretty rich source of omega-3 fatty acids, and those are your really good anti-inflammatory fatty acid. But they don't stop there. They've got a lot of the essential amino acids. They've got all of the essential amino acids, actually. They're really high in antioxidants. They got a ton of fiber. They can absorb up to 10 times their weight in water, which means that you get a lot slower absorption of sugar into the body when you consume chia seeds along with other foods or along with carbohydrates. And they've been used for a long time. They were used by Aztec warriors as an endurance-promoting food. They would take chia seeds, and they'd eat chia seeds with bread before battle, and they would also make a chia seed gel. They would literally take a handful of chia seeds, soak them until they became a gel in water, and then consume that before they would run long distances. The thing about chia seeds is, of course, they're not quite as convenient as grabbing an energy gel or grabbing an energy bar. However, the question is, are they as effective as carbohydrates? A study just came out, just released in 2010 in the National Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, where they compared carbohydrate loading, traditional carbohydrate loading protocol, with loading with omega-3 fatty acids from chia seeds instead. So one group of runners drank 100% of their calories from Gatorade to do carbohydrate loading, and the other group simply drank a chia seed drink, which basically was 50% chia seeds and 50% Gatorade. So they still did have some carbs in there. And then they ran for an hour, and then they went and did a 10K time trial after they ran for an hour. Neither group did better than the other group, but both groups did about the same as far as significance goes. So the answer here is that chia seeds, at least in this study, when mixed with sugar, can allow you to consume 50% less sugar and still do just as well. And that's really cool for people who are concerned about their overall carbohydrate intake, who are concerned about their blood sugar levels, and who still want to maintain the same amount of energy. They haven't hit the mainstream, in my opinion, just because they are a little bit spendy and they're a little bit, at this point, impractical or logistically difficult to incorporate into your training protocol. But I'm a huge fan of taking a handful of chia seeds, dumping them into some water, making some gel, and consuming those. I interviewed a gentleman named Telman Knudsen on this podcast last year. He was running across the entire country barefoot, and he was primarily fueling himself just on chia seeds. So definite advantage to them, especially for people who don't want to consume a lot of carbohydrates. No problem with taking them. They are very power-packed and have a lot of benefits. So next question comes via Twitter. And L Smoothie asks via Twitter, just wanted to know, when you're jogging, how detrimental is stopping for a breather to maintain your fitness? Well, the short answer is that it's not detrimental at all. The reason for that is that if you are exercising and you're jogging and you're getting to the point where you have to stop because it's getting so hard to breathe and you walk it off and then you start jogging again, that's interval training. That's what interval training is. And interval training like that has been shown to be far more beneficial than like long, steady state aerobic training in terms of helping you to have a bigger lung capacity, to add more oxygen-consuming mitochondria to your muscle cells, to improve your blood delivery, to basically improve all these different parameters of aerobic fitness. Now, of course, the issue here is that if you're training for something like a marathon, and you are having to stop to take a breather every few minutes while you're jogging, you may want to look into your running economy or your running efficiency, like your running form, to make sure that you are not running in a fashion that's making you use up more energy than you should be using, that's making you breathe too hard. So I would definitely encourage you, if you are trying to get to the point where you can run for long periods of time without stopping, so if you're doing this for competition, not for fitness, to look into like getting a biomechanical gait analysis, or just read a book like Qi Running or Pose Running, or one of these books that really teaches you how to run properly and efficiently without actually using up too much energy. But ultimately, if you're out exercising and you have to stop to take a breather and then keep going again, that's a great way to train. That's interval training, and it works very well. One of my favorite workouts is to just go for a long walk, and every 3 minutes during that walk, I do a 60-second sprint. And when I finish a exercise session like that, I'm a lot more tired than if I just went out for a kind of a medium-paced 60-minute jog. So there's definite benefits to that. The next question is from David. David says, I'm using your Triathlon Dominator program to train for Ironman South Africa, and I've gotten stronger and leaned up, but have started to notice prominent veins in my arms and legs, particularly in my legs. I don't think that's necessarily a problem, but just want to be sure, is this normal and healthy? Yes, it's fine. As your body fat percentage decreases and the size of your blood vessels increase to deliver more blood to active muscles, you're going to notice that you have more sightly veins and that you tend to just have more of these blood vessels popping up and appearing. Completely normal. Even the little bumps that appear, which are basically valves, those are completely normal as well. Based on genetics, some people have a lot more veins than others. I'm sure you've seen those people who have basically clumps of veins all over their bodies. And whereas a lot of the times that's just genetic, you do need to be careful that you're not, say, exercising and then just sitting around and letting blood pool in an area after you exercise. That's a great way to contribute to the formation of these clumps of varicose veins. So by using things like compression socks, cool downs, ice baths, hot baths, some of the things that are just kind of common sense recovery protocols after you exercise, you'll eliminate a lot of your risk of developing some of these more unsightly veins and clumps of veins. But you really can't do anything about the blood vessels actually showing up. It's really normal in both males and females. Next question is from Cherie. And Cherie says, what's your take on oxygen in a small can to help with runs? Do you really think it would make a difference? Now, what Cherie is referring to is these new supplements that are popping up, and it's basically like canned oxygen, portable canned oxygen, and you pop this stuff open and you literally kind of suck it in while you're exercising with the idea that you're going to give yourself more oxygen to be able to utilize while you're exercising. Now, first of all, don't get me wrong. There is absolutely no benefit of doing something like taking in extra oxygen before you go out and perform. And the reason for that is that the body is able to maintain its levels of oxygen very well, and its sensors for how much oxygen that it uses are based on the partial pressure of oxygen in your bloodstream, meaning that once your blood is fully saturated with oxygen, taking in more oxygen over and above that level isn't going to help you at all. And the same can be said for after exercise. Once you've exercised, if you're using extra oxygen, like breathing pure oxygen or using this canned oxygen thing, that's going to assist you with recovery. Again, it seems logical that that would boost the recovery process by, you know, assisting with extra metabolism or maybe helping you balance out all the CO2 you produced or all the acid in your body. The fact is that your body does a really good job on its own taking any of the oxygen that you're breathing in and diverting the extra that's necessary to the muscles, and taking in added oxygen over and above that has never been shown to actually assist with recovery. However, the one time in which oxygen supplementation could be helpful is during exercise. And there's a ton of scientific research that suggests that athletes could be able to exercise longer or with a higher intensity when they take in extra oxygen during their physical exertion. And the reason that you take in oxygen during exercise is based off the fact that when you're exercising, the rate of the supply of oxygen to your working muscles is not satisfying the demand of those muscles for oxygen. So if you're taking in extra oxygen, you could saturate your blood with more oxygen and then supply that oxygen without actually increasing your blood flow or your heart rate. And so what that means is that your body will basically be getting tricked into thinking that it has just as much oxygen on board during exercise as it does at rest. And so it's not going to have to bump up the heart rate more to deliver extra oxygen to the muscles, or say increase the size of the blood vessels and drop your blood pressure to deliver more oxygen to the muscles. So it could actually work. The trick is to do it logistically. Now, I've never used this canned oxygen before, but compared to actually wearing a mask connected to like an oxygen tank while you're exercising, it seems like it would be it could actually work. The question is, would a quick injection of like a 100% oxygen formula actually last, or would you get just this very, very quick surge in oxygen and then lose the effects of that right away? In other words, would taking in 100% oxygen in quick spurts during exercise be just as advantageous as breathing extra oxygen during the entire exercise scenario? And that's something that hasn't been studied, in my opinion. There isn't anything that I know of that's actually taken this portable canned oxygen and done a full-on study with it. It would be great if they could do this. It would be even better if they could study the effect of this versus a continuous oxygen feed via like a mask and a tank. So ultimately, it does have some promise. The question is, would it actually work when delivered in very small spurts? So, good question. The next one comes from Tyler. Tyler says, I've heard many times that carbonated water is really bad for you and can hurt your fitness or your speed, but I've heard you say that you love carbonated water. Could you clear this up for me? Well, there is a ton of information on the internet that suggests that drinking carbonated water could leach calcium from your bones, could cause osteoporosis, could hurt the enamel on your teeth, irritate your stomach. There's even something I've seen that says that carbonated water could cause cancer. And on the flip side, you've probably heard me say before that carbonated water is a great way to kind of keep your appetite satiated, keep your stomach full. It's really good if you're trying to wean yourself off soda or diet soda. And the fact is that carbonated water does not leach calcium from your bones. The reason that that myth exists is because soda has carbonation in it, and soda can leach calcium from your bones or has been linked to lower bone mineral density. However, this does not happen with the intake of carbonated water. They've actually done studies on this. They've compared regular water versus carbonated water, looked at the bone density after 8 weeks of consumption, and found absolutely no difference between the two. Now, as far as your teeth goes, the same thing. They've done research where they soaked teeth in still water versus carbonated water and found absolutely no difference in the harm to the teeth. And that's because pretty much any water, unless it's been completely leached of minerals, has enough calcium and other minerals in it that kind of buffer the effects of the carbonic acid that's added to the carbonated water. And so unless your carbonated water is completely void of minerals, and there's no carbonated water that I know of that has all the minerals just sucked out of it, it's not going to be a problem. Now, when you're talking about soda water, a lot of times if they're adding flavors to soda water, the flavors can make the soda water more acidic, and that flavor could contribute to erosion on the teeth and erosion of tooth enamel. And of course, carbonated water in a soft drink like a Coke or a Pepsi would undoubtedly contribute to tooth enamel, and that has been proven before. Now, as far as damaging your throat or damaging your stomach, there's been research where they've taken people and divided them into two groups. And whereas both groups were suffering from indigestion, they had one group drink regular water and the other group drink carbonated water. And the group that drank the carbonated water had far less indigestion, and they also had less constipation, whereas the group that drank the regular water didn't really notice any change at all. So carbonated water, especially if you suffer from indigestion, can do you a lot of favors because it helps you burp up a lot of the extra gases and things that are collecting in your stomach and causing some of that irritation. And again, no evidence that the carbonated water will do any damage to your throat or damage to your stomach. And there, of course, is zero evidence that carbonated water could cause cancer. So not only is there really no evidence that vilifies carbonated water, on the flip side, it can help your stomach feel fuller. It can reduce your appetite. It can help you eat less at meals. It can help wean you off of soda. So I am, until I see research that says otherwise, a big fan of carbonated water, and you'd really have to show me the studies to prove that carbonated water is not safe in order for me to change my opinion on that. So the next question comes from Gary, and Gary says, I'm working with a 15-year-old kid who's taking a circuit training class. He wants to gain muscle but struggles since most of his food isn't absorbed. He has attempted to keep weight on by eating heavy fat foods and fast foods. I know healthy foods are fewer calories, so what can I suggest for food, and how can I help him? Well, the first thing is, in last week's podcast, I did mention that people who have trouble putting on weight should definitely look into improving the function of their intestinal tract, meaning take digestive enzymes and take probiotics to help you absorb more of the calories and the nutrients from the foods that you do eat. And that will help you put on weight right there. But in addition to that, complete myth, Gary, when you say healthy food contains fewer calories. There are many healthy foods out there that are calorie dense. I'm going to run through some of the ones that I would suggest that you make a staple in his diet. And these are straight from my book, Holistic Fueling for Triathletes, in which I teach you how to fuel your body with 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 calories a day and still not do a lot of damage to your body, you know, by eating Big Macs and drinking Sunny D. So starting off, almond butter. Almond butter, very, very calorie dense. It's lower on the glycemic index than peanut butter. It has a lot lower potential for triggering food allergies than peanut butter does. You can take almonds, you can grind them in your coffee grinder and make them yourself with that and olive oil, or you can go out and buy almond butter. Avocados, excellent source of healthy fats that are utilized very, very efficiently for energy. Avocados are pretty calorie dense as a healthy fat. We talked about milk earlier, but I would definitely recommend milk. I would recommend that you get him on an organic milk if possible, and even better, something like an organic goat's milk. In the same vein, also be including organic protein. Now, I personally, when I'm in the throes of training, I will literally eat about 6 scoops of that Mount Capra organic protein on any given day, and I mix that with coconut milk and almond butter. So I'm taking like these 600-calorie shots during the day of pure fat and protein, but I'm not getting a lot of the toxins and a lot of the omega-6 fatty acids, the inflammation, the chemicals that I would get if I were, say, drinking like a store-bought protein shake, or say taking in, you know, like a hamburger or a fast food taco or something like that. Pumpkin seeds and nuts in general, but pumpkin seeds especially can be a great source of antioxidants, good source of selenium, great for growth. A few other good ones would be Brazil nuts, walnuts, and then soaking flax seeds or chia seeds, like we already mentioned, soaking those in water for a couple of hours until they form a gel. Also very useful in terms of a high calorie, dense energy source. Sweet potatoes and yams, I would be doing a ton of those. Again, very dense, more carbohydrate-rich energy source. You can, again, mix those with like an almond butter. You could put like a raw honey on them, a little bit of sea salt. Again, wonderful nutrient-dense source of energy. Look at lentils and beans. You can take like chickpeas and garbanzo beans, put those in a blender with a little tahini, some olive oil, some garlic, some salt, some pepper, and you have yourself hummus that is very calorie dense in like a paste form that can be eaten with just about anything. Look into some of the healthier, really protein-packed grains. Quinoa, amaranth, and millet would be the top three. He or his mom can batch cook those at the beginning of the week and have a huge pot of that stuff that can be mixed with vegetables, mixed with seeds, nuts, you know, feta cheese, anything like that to draw on during the week. Bread can really help you to balloon up, as anybody who's trying to lose weight knows. But again, for gaining weight, bread is really going to help keep weight on. Definitely get the sprouted variety. So when you're at the store looking for bread, a lot of times the sprouted stuff will be in the frozen food section. Ezekiel is one example, but grabbing bread and doing, again, you can do like almond butter and honey with bread. You can have hummus with bread and put a bunch of vegetables on there and some lean turkey breast or some lean roast beef from the deli counter. Again, tons of ways that you could get a bunch of food into his diet. So I hope that helps. Chuck asks, I want to understand better why we benefit more from training, for example, 6 days a week, as opposed to just going really hard 2 or 3 days in a row and then taking a day off. Well, there actually is no added benefit or no extra benefit to, say, going really hard for 2 or 3 days and then taking a few days off and coming back and repeating again when it comes to fitness. The issue is that your body on those days off can have some issues with nutrition, meaning that because exercise decreases your appetite and makes you more sensitive to insulin, if your exercise scenario is such that you're doing, say, 3 days really hard and then 3 or 4 days off, on those off days, you're much more likely to not only eat more, but you're more likely for the foods that you're eating to destabilize your blood sugar levels far more significantly than if you were exercising on those days. So when it comes to weight gain and health, exercising for a shorter period of time, possibly at slightly lower intensities for 6 to 7 days of the week, is far more effective at weight maintenance, health, and still maintains fitness compared to just doing a couple of really hard exercise days and then taking a few days off. But if weight loss or health or blood sugar levels are really not of importance to you, then there's really not a big difference between going out and exercising for, say, 3 hours a day, 3 days a week, and then sitting around the other days. Ultimately, there's really not going to be a big difference in terms of your fitness. Next question comes from Joshua, who says, my bike sessions are all on an indoor trainer right now due to the weather, so I have complete control over my environment. When I have my longer aerobic rides on the weekend, should I focus on spinning fast at a low gear, moderate in a medium gear, or slowly in a big gear to keep my heart rate aerobic? And the answer to that is that you should focus on spinning fast at a low gear. Don't think of your aerobic sessions, if you're training on a bicycle, as just junk sessions where all you're doing is burning calorie or, say, just getting a little bit of extra blood flow for recovery. Teach your nerves to fire more quickly during those sessions. So, for example, you've heard me say before that I wake up in the morning and do an unfed cardio session on my bike, typically 3 to 4 days a week for around an hour. I'll spin at 90 to 95 RPM during those sessions. So not only am I getting in my fasted aerobic session to help with fat burning later on, but I'm also training my legs to get really used to spinning at a high cadence. So once I start doing harder sessions, getting ready for races, etc., it's a lot easier for me to adopt that high pedaling cadence that is associated with being able to basically generate a higher power with a lower rating of perceived exertion. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some people that do very, very well mashing gears on their bicycle during a race. But ultimately, for most people, you're going to have better results when you spin at a high cadence. You're going to be able to produce a higher power with less effort when you're spinning at a high cadence. So why not train yourself to do that even during your aerobic sessions? Plus, long term, it could be a little bit easier on your knees. And then a final question, which was asked via Twitter by Twitter user Army Leg. They ask, how did Ben Greenfield eat as a kid, and how did he eat as a bodybuilder, and how has his diet changed since? All right, I know you guys don't want to hear my life story, so I'm going to keep this pretty quick. As a kid, I ate like pretty much any typical kid raised in a Western diet environment. We would do typically 2 or 3 nights a week, we'd have pizza. So we'd go get typically a U-Bake pizza, like a Papa Murphy's Take and Bake type of thing. And we'd have that with salad and ranch dressing. So we did get the salad in there, but that was very, very frequent. Typically twice a week, we'd do McDonald's or fast food, usually like Whopper Day at Burger King. A lot of times we'd drive through the drive-thru at McDonald's and we'd grab like huge bags of the 29-cent, 39-cent cheeseburgers or hamburgers. And, you know, my mom would get like 50 of those and we'd just feed off those for the next few days. A lot of like macaroni and cheese out of the box, straight up Kraft macaroni and cheese. Breakfast, usually like Captain Crunch, peanut butter Captain Crunch, Frosted Flakes, stuff like that. Sometimes like toast with eggs, pretty typical fare. Dinners, when they weren't pizza or fast food, a lot of times like big vats of chili. I grew up in a family with 5 kids, so not a huge family, but not a small family. So a lot of batch cooking, chilies, stews, things of that nature. You know, like chicken casseroles, stuff like that. When I moved on from that and really didn't know how to cook anything but essentially omelets and stir fry when I got to college, I did a lot of the same things for breakfast, tons of cereal, typically would have everything from Top Ramen to microwaved hot dogs to tuna out of the can to whatever steak happened to be on sale during college. For my first 2 to 3 years of college, that was basically what I ate. And tried to squeeze in vegetables every now and again, too. Typically, I go through about 2 jars of peanut butter a week, not organic peanut butter, just like the regular saturated peanut butter, like Jiffy's or whatever happened to be on sale. I would eat that by the tablespoon while I was doing my homework and all that jazz. And essentially, it was just like a, you know, human garbage disposal because it was cheap and it filled me up. Yeah, I got sick a lot. I probably got a cold, you know, once every couple of months. And man, if I could go back and do it again, I'm sure I would have straight A's all through college because I know that a lot of times I was not thinking as clearly as I would have if I had all the nutrients on board that I needed and didn't have all those omega-6 fatty acids circulating through my bloodstream. As a kid, I would frequently get stomach aches. I would throw up. I would have GI tract issues. I found out later that I had lactose intolerance, but I was drinking anywhere from 4 to 5 glasses of just regular 2% milk a day. So I'm sure that wasn't doing me any favors. Neither was the ice cream that I was eating at night. Finally, starting into bodybuilding, that's when I started to get a little bit more interest in nutrition and eating right and doing some of the things that can strip fat off your body. Granted, I went the traditional bodybuilding route. I did a ton of canned protein shakes. Like the, I remember the brand that I did was ABB or Muscle Milk, both of those. So canned protein shakes, Muscle Milk, did a lot of tuna out of the can, kept doing a lot of steaks. I was eating a very high protein, low fiber, a low carbohydrate diet, had a lot of issues with hormones, with sex drive, with constipation, with a lot of things that can go hand in hand with just switching to a high protein diet but not doing it intelligently, essentially just grabbing dense protein sources, not taking in extra fiber, not considering healthy fats, and not considering carbohydrate needs when you're doing aerobic exercise. So I was drained. You know, even when I was bodybuilding, I was doing things like teaching spin class, and I remember having zero energy during spin class. And then finally, you know, when I started to get out of bodybuilding and began to study nutrition at a master's degree level in university, learning a little bit more about essential nutrients, vitamins, and minerals, and how they work within the human body for things like brain development, body development, muscle development, and also started taking some more advanced nutrition classes on the side, started to study to attain a sports nutrition certification, began to learn a lot more about the little holes that I wasn't filling in what I perceived to be a healthy diet when I was bodybuilding. And since then, after graduating and attaining a sports nutrition certification and going on and doing lots of studying, I'm typically reading on any given day anywhere from 15 to 50 pages of nutrition and fitness research. And I usually go through anywhere from 5 to 8 books in any given month on those type of topics. And so, you know, that's what you hear reflected on the Ben Greenfield Fitness podcast. That's why a lot of the stuff you hear is stuff that you might read in books, you know, 5, 10 years from now when this stuff finally hits the mainstream, but that I'm giving to you now because I'm getting my hands in this research right when it comes out. So, you know, everything from the Journal of Strength Conditioning Research to the Journal of Metabolism to every single diet book that comes out, and then going through the citations in those diet books, going back to the research, looking at that. I subscribe to the Stone Hearth newsletter on nutrition, subscribe to a bunch of different nutrition newsletters, usually scour PubMed on a regular basis. So I'm going through a lot of this stuff now, and it's kind of a constantly evolving process, and probably the most intimate you could get with it is now inside the inner circle where, you know, Jess and I we're basically writing down the meal plan that we implement with our family every day. And we're giving that out to people on the forum and putting in PDFs, video recording a lot of what we do on a daily basis. And I don't want to brag or anything here, but my kids are so much more privileged and are going to go through life so much more healthy, so much more free of sickness and gastrointestinal issues, and perform better, think better, do better, be better because of what we're giving them from a nutritional standpoint. So, I mean, man, if I could go back over and have all that, I would be doing myself such a huge favor. But the best I can do, of course, is give that to my kids. So I hope that answers your question. I thought it was a good question. Hopefully I didn't bore you guys too much with that. So we're pushing close to an hour already. We need to move on and get into this interview with Chris Bohannon on body cooling devices. So part one is going to be with Chris. And then after Chris, next week, we're bringing Tim Ferriss and a NASA materials engineer on to talk more about body cooling.
Did you know you can get personalized nutrition and fitness consulting from Ben Greenfield no matter who you are? If you want to run a triathlon, lose a few pounds, reinvent your diet, or have Ben create a training program or nutrition plan that's customized to you, here's what you need to do. Visit tinyurl.com/help from Ben. That's tinyurl.com/help from Ben. Ben will personally contact you within 48 hours. What are you waiting for? Visit tinyurl.com/help from Ben today and get the body and results you've always wanted. Featured topic.
Hey folks, this is Ben Greenfield, and I'm here with Chris Bohannon. And if you're somebody who has ever, say, worn a wetsuit or maybe some compression gear or even played around with some of the advanced
bike type of biomechanics or performance gear that's out there in cycling or triathlon or swimming, you may have come across something that was designed by, or at least had a lot of input from, the guy who I've got on the phone right now, who happens to be a biomechanist, an expert in triathlon technology. He's working with Orbea right now. But today, we're going to be talking about compression gear and specifically cooling devices, things that you can wear that can keep you cool while you're competing. So, Chris, thanks for coming on the call.
Yeah, thanks.
So, you know, we've seen, say, in a race like Ironman Hawaii, the Ironman World Championships, that people are wearing these tight pieces of compression on their arms or their legs, and it turns out that that stuff is designed not just for compression, but some of it actually allows the body to cool. Now, how does body cooling compression gear actually work?
Well, there's a variety of different types of modalities to do the cooling. There's a fabric like Cold Black, which is a black material that actually, the black fabric that doesn't get hot and it actually gets cold. And then there's fabric like Icefill, which is a fabric that has xylitol infused in it. I'm sure you're familiar with xylitol, anybody who's ever had gum in their mouth. You chew gum and it causes this cooling sensation in your mouth. That's from xylitol. It's a plant-based sugar that causes, when it gets wet, causes an endothermic reaction. So we made some compression arm sleeves with xylitol infused in that. So when the body was sweating, it would then activate the xylitol, create a cooling sensation on the skin, and then, therefore, subconsciously the athlete is feeling this cooling sensation.
Interesting. So what's an endothermic reaction, just to clarify for the people who aren't in chemistry?
Well, these crystals vibrate back and forth, and they create cooling as opposed to heat in your exothermic, or you've got your endothermic, and your endothermic, and the response is radiates the cooling towards the object. And I'm trying to think of a better example. If I think of one, I'll mention it. But can't think of one right offhand.
Basically, when a chemical reaction occurs with this stuff, it's actually essentially sucking up heat and producing a cooling sensation.
Yes, and we saw temperature drops of about 11 to 12 degrees within about 120 seconds of it being wet.
Holy cow! Now, you said you use the term that, you know, you may be able to sense this psychologically and it could help you perform. But, you know, when in your research or from what you've seen, what exactly are the advantages, say, in hot competition to allowing the body to stay cooler, either before you even start or during or after?
Well, this is where it always gets touchy, because being a scientist, I'm pretty objective. On an objective, and research clearly shows that topical cooling agents don't necessarily lower core body temperature, and that's really the goal. Like, when we consume water when we're exercising, we lower core body temperature, and when we lower core body temperature, heart rate drops, caloric expenditure drops. So, therefore, we have more calories to burn longer. There's many people who claim that by cooling the skin, you can then cool the body, and that doesn't actually happen. What actually happens is that there's a brain response, and there's a sensation of cooling, and we've seen numerous studies where it's almost like playing mind games. If you can trick the mind into thinking that it's cooler, your body will start to modify its response. And a simple example of that is when you put carbohydrate in your mouth and you swish carbohydrate around and you spit it out, the cells in the mouth start to modify and the body starts to change based on the fact that there's carbohydrate in your mouth, even though you haven't consumed it. So the goal is obviously, if we can provide, one, sun protection, which is the other advantage to this with an SPF, you know, of 50 and keep the UV rays off. But then this cooling sensation, you start to think, okay, maybe I am getting cooler. A lot of other companies are putting materials like coal black or ice-fill down the spine because they feel that that is the fastest way to activate the neurons in the body is through, you know, putting this cooling sensation directly on the spine.
Very interesting. And it reminds me also of the study I recently saw where when people were cramping, they just tasted a salty solution like pickle juice, and it helped to reverse the cramp even though it was all mental, like it was actually acting like on the nervous system. Interesting.
Yeah.
So we've got this xylitol-based compression gear, and you guys somehow build this xylitol into the gear that people then wear on their body?
Yeah, it's infused in the yarn. So it's wrapped in the yarn. And over time, it'll wash out. But you get probably a good 20 washes out of a garment that has xylitol before it starts to wear out.
Interesting. Now, in addition to the xylitol, prior to mentioning it, you said something about some type of black gear that reflected sun or also caused a cooling sensation. What were you referring to there?
Well, cold black material has been around a while. It hasn't really been readily accepted in sport. I mean, it's just now kind of coming around. Everybody knows that, you know, white gear typically stays cooler than black gear. And so with this cold black material, it actually reflects the heat off the body and keeps the garment cool. And I think Pearl Izumi is probably the best example. They're using it a lot, and so is Castelli in their cycling gear. It's I guess the hardest part is to get people to wear black clothes,
mm-hmm.
because there is this presumed heat generation, or it's presumed that a black garment is much, much hotter than a white garment.
Right. Interesting. So when you're talking about the use of these type of cooling or the use of this cooling clothing or cooling gear, is there anything dangerous about it? I mean, are there certain conditions or certain people that shouldn't be wearing this stuff that you know of? Or
I have never read any research that would say, that would speak to it being a contraindication for anybody.
Okay.
At this point, I don't know that we know. I don't know that we've used it enough to really know if it has any negative effects. I can't imagine that it does. I mean, I get that question all the time just talking about compression gear. And, you know, is compression gear bad for people? Typically, what we find is that it's not. Actually, it helps prolong the life of veins and arteries as opposed to damaging them over time. So at this point, I don't think that we do know.
Gotcha. Okay. So what type of people are actually using this gear at this point? Is this, I mean, I've seen it in pro Ironman triathletes competing in hot conditions, but are there other people or folks in other conditions who are using this type of cooling gear?
Well, we're seeing a lot of we're seeing cyclists use it a lot, and then more in like the NFL, what we see is the cooling vests and wearing the cooling vests underneath their gear or in warm up or in between quarters, where it's actually this inflatable vest where they can pump in ice cold water and drop the body temperature. Now that has been shown to actually lower core temperature because of the fact that you can produce such a cooling effect almost to the point of where the water is ice. We don't actually get that kind of temperature in a xylitol-based garment.
Very interesting.
So
these cooling vests, are they something that is available to the general population to use, or are those just kind of accessible to the NFL?
Well, they are actually available. Nike actually makes one. And actually, Nike was one of the first people to ever really push it forward. It was about 4 or 5 years ago. And then we saw it, I believe it was Frank Schleck, who was wearing it in a tour either this year, I believe, or last year before one of the stages. And so now it's because it's in the media more, kind of like Normatec boots, it's now readily available to the public.
Gotcha.
And it's not all that expensive either.
So, well, how expensive is something like that?
Cooling vests right now, you can get them, I think it's the retail price is somewhere around $200,
okay,
which is pretty affordable. You look at xylitol-based arm sleeves, they run about $50.
Mm-hmm.
So you start to like look at the gamut of or the range of prices, and so you're looking anywhere between $30 or $40 for a DeSoto piece up to a cooling vest at about $200.
Now, you mentioned that they're using this during cycling. They're using it in the NFL. Are people only using it prior to activity, or are people wearing these body cooling vests during competition as well?
I don't know of anybody that's racing or competing in a cooling vest at this point. Now, it wouldn't surprise me if NFL players had xylitol-based tops or heat gear or, as Under Armour calls it, something that's managing moisture and body temperature, or, a lot of companies mess around with different yarns. Like polypropylene, for example, has a lower heat retention rate than nylon spandex. So, and it also consequently has a lower moisture absorption rate. So you have a garment that stays dry and stays cool, as opposed to like a Lycra garment that gets very wet and gets very hot very quickly. So there's a lot of different ways to approach cooling on the skin, whether it's a garment that's actually going to drop in temperature, or it's actually a fabric that, or a yarn that's going to actually stay at ambient temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I wouldn't be surprised if we're seeing more and more of this in pro sports. I mean, basketball being an inside sport, probably not as much. Potentially baseball for sure, and then obviously football. Hockey uses a lot of thermal gear just because of the temperature on the ice.
Right. Now, speaking of temperatures, I know a lot of the audience probably thinks a little bit like I do, especially when it comes to something like, say, a triathlon. Let's say that I decided I was going to get one of these body cooling vests, and I was going to sit with it for however many minutes you're supposed to wear it prior to a race, while I'm getting ready in transition area or whatever. And then I'm going to also wear this xylitol-based body cooling gear while I'm competing, all with the goal of keeping my core temperature low. Do I reach a point of diminishing returns? I mean, do you get to a point where your body gets too cold and is using up too much energy trying to stay warm?
I would find that condition to be highly unlikely. Because if you're actively warming up as you're wearing the vest, I mean, your heart is going to respond to the exercise or the warm-up. So it's going to accelerate. And then as you're exercising, you're not going to get an intense temperature drop from the xylitol that would cause, your body to become cold. I think more if you're pouring ice water in your body, you would probably start to get that response where it could be detrimental, but not from a garment like a xylitol-based garment or a cold black garment.
Interesting. So that kind of leads to another question about keeping the body cool. Do you imagine that something like this, and the reason I ask this is because Tim Ferriss, who's going to be coming on the show actually the week after this interview is released to talk more about body cooling, he mentions the use of body cooling for weight loss. Have you ever hypothesized that someone might actually use one of these devices that you're helping to create to actually keep them cool so they burn more calories to lose weight?
I guess I had never really thought of it in that aspect. I suppose it's possible. I mean, I would question what it does to metabolism. Mm-hmm.
I just thought I'd run it by you. I was curious if
I think it's a possibility.
It'd definitely be a whole brand new market for these type of devices. Now,
yes, absolutely.
Can somebody basically kind of skip, spending the $200 on a cooling vest and buying this xylitol-based compression gear and just do things like, say, stand underneath a hose of cold water before they head out for their race, and then during the race, say, like, you know, eat ice, dump cold water on their head, use cold sponges. I mean, what's the difference between doing something like that versus using this type of engineered body cooling gear?
Well, all those things are great ways to lower core temperature and stay hydrated. I think that, you know, hydration is typically the fastest way for us to lower core temperature. All of those things are great. I think one of the advantages of an engineered garment is not only can we provide cooling, active cooling, without having to put anything on the skin, but then you can have graduated compression to decrease swelling or to provide muscular support, and then you've also got the sun aspect, which is just as important because the sun is what's heating up the body or is adding more heat to the body. So if we can keep sunburn, off of the body, then that also helps too, because the sunburn will actually, the body will start to burn more calories.
So you're basically killing several birds with one stone by using compression gear and having like some type of cooling device built into the compression gear.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, yeah. I have one last question for you is about these gloves. I've heard that you can actually wear a special type of glove that will assist with body cooling as well. Is that true?
Well, I think this first became popular when Thorbjörn Sembali wore rubber gloves and put ice in there in hopes of keeping his wrists cool to lower temperature. And the problem was is that the water would get hot and there was no way for it to breathe. So the rubber actually, you know, the water would heat up and then there was no way to breathe. I think, you know, where this really started to have some research behind it was when we started to look at weightlifters who were doing maximal sets and then sticking their hands inside a box that then closed around their wrist, and they would press down on a button. They would grip a hand grip and push down on a button, and that grip would get very cold. And what they found was is that it immediately dropped temperature, and it immediately increased power output when they go back out and do another set. And I think that there is some validity to that. However, again, it's hard to gauge what's placebo and what's not placebo because of the mind is such an amazing machine. You know, if we start, there's a lot of arguments that placebo doesn't even really exist because if you think it, then your body can adjust, like you said with the pickle juice or with carbohydrate. So it throws all of this into this very complex question of, you know, if you think it, can you make it happen? And I don't know. I think that anything that you find as a positive is great.
Yeah.
And if it's something that it works for you and that you're comfortable with it, then I think it's great. You know, the research is always very iffy on these things. However, we have tons of anecdotal evidence that suggests that they do in fact work.
Interesting. Well, folks, if you're listening in and you're listening in when this interview is released, especially if you're living in a cold climate, you're probably not really thinking too much about this right now because it's the middle of the winter. However, if you have questions about this or you'd like to follow up on it, head over to the website at bengreenfieldfitness.com, over to the show notes and leave your questions. And then also stay tuned because I'll actually be traveling to several hot races starting in March all the way through October, and I plan on experimenting with some of these body cooling devices in a couple of those events, and I'll report on that over at bengreenfieldfitness.com so that you can listen in and find out my thoughts on how this stuff works for competition. Chris, I'd like to thank you for coming on the call today.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, this is Chris Bohannon and Ben Greenfield signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com.
Well, folks, remember, we don't mess around on the show notes. At bengreenfieldfitness.com, you can learn more. You can click on links to everything I've talked about, including all the new supplements at Pacific Elite Fitness, from the new protein to the vitamin D to the fish oil, super prices on all that stuff. So be sure to check that out, as well as links to everything else that we talked about. Now, remember to leave the show a ranking in iTunes by going to iTunes and doing a search for Ben Greenfield Fitness and leave a review, leave a ranking. It really helps the show out. Next week, we'll have part two with Tim Ferriss and Ray Cronice, a NASA materials engineer, talking about body cooling and specifically body cooling with regards to weight management. That'll be a fascinating interview. You won't want to miss that. So until next time, this is Ben Greenfield signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Finally, a solution for healthy living that actually makes sense. Ben Greenfield and his wife Jessa have cracked the code on healthy living and revealed their entire system inside the Ben Greenfield Fitness Inner Circle, where you'll get instant access to 24/7 forum interaction with Ben and Jessa, a live monthly webinar, meal plans, videos, Ben's Body Transformation Club archives, and much, much more. If you or your family want to learn how to achieve the ultimate healthy lifestyle on a budget, then the Ben Greenfield Fitness Inner Circle is for you. Get four free videos to get you started and full access to the Inner Circle at BenGreenfieldFitness.com/Inner Circle. That's BenGreenfieldFitness.com/Inner Circle. We'll see you inside.